Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 30th, 2006. Today's session is entitled, A Whole Lot of Shaking Going On, from Matthew 24, verses 29 through 31, presented by Michael Pellet. The number is POM-M-2006-11. Let us listen in.
Thank you. It's a little tougher when you're up at 4:30. Most of us were, I'm sure. Anyway, I'm Michael Pellet, and I teach at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon, and I'm also a Lutheran pastor there at a congregation in Saskatoon. And this week we're looking at Matthew chapter 24, talk about the end of the world and what that means in the light of our theme text and theme verse for the year, or for this summer season, Matthew 28:16-20, which has Jesus saying, I am with you always. And so if we have that promise, that assurance that Christ is with us always, what would a notion of the end of the world mean? What would that be? How do we understand that? And as by now you know, my way of looking at that is to say it's a notion of how we live between the two resurrections, the resurrection of Jesus and our own resurrection, which is to come. And so as we have been looking at that, we have seen that indeed our temples and everything that we might idolize and where we might want to place God or God's presence will usually come crashing down. And that indeed we are to center on Christ and on Christ alone. From that, we've gone on as the disciples ask, when will your coming be? What will be signs? Jesus goes on to talk about the trials and difficulties that might befall us, how there are the external pressures, how there is internal crumbling and all that that might entail, and that indeed the worst of all things, notions of lovelessness and lawlessness. And we've discussed all of those things and what is happening there. It ended up yesterday with looking at verse 14 of chapter 24. Getting at, and this good news of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the world as a testimony to all the nations. And so we were talking about exactly what is that good news of God's reign and rule among us and what that all entails. And we looked and discussed that for quite a bit, so long, in fact, that we never got to what we were supposed to, but who cares? In fact, I still don't want to leave verse 14 alone. I want to talk about that a little more. I know. But it's got to be done. I'm sorry. It's got to be done. And I want to look at that yet within the context of one of Jesus' parables earlier in Matthew's gospel. Matthew chapter 13, verses 31 to 42. So if you look at, 31 to 32, I want. Yes, Matthew 13, 31 to 32. And someone finds that. They would read that for us, please. I'm sure once you hear it, it'll be familiar to many of you. But if someone would read that. Go ahead, anybody.
He put before them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed that someone took and sowed in his field. It is the smallest of all the seeds. But when it has grown, it is the greatest of shrubs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches.
All right. Okay.
What does that have to do? And key things, mustard seeds, the smallest, it becomes the greatest shrub. And then bird's nest. What does that have to do with what we're talking about? Anyone want to give that a try? It starts from something very small, because remember, we've had many false teachers, many go away. Many false teachers, many go away. So that we're left with the singular, or we're left with the small, right? The mustard seed community, if you will, that is there. And yet, miraculously, it grows such that it becomes the greatest, and yet it's still the greatest shrub, right? It's not the greatest tree. And shrubs usually aren't that great. I know, sorry if I've offended any shrub lovers.
Actually, in the Gideon Bible, it is a tree.
Yeah. It is a tree in the Gideon Bible. Well, it's not really. it's like a big bush, okay? And then the significant thing here is that the birds nest, right? That what this community does again, what this seed does as it grows, right? That the birds can nest in it, it provides shelter. It provides, if you were the eye opener this morning, home. It is, if you will, here as we've been talking about that, an action and activity of love in a world which becomes lawless and loveless. The other sense about this is from this smallest to the greatest, again, to show what's here. We've said yesterday how if we keep going this way, from Matthew's understanding, arrested, handed over, so on and so forth, you end up with the cross. You end up with a sense of death. But out of that cross and out of that death comes resurrection, comes life. There is the sense here, and we'll put it in Latin so that, of course, that way it is far more impressive. The notion here of creatio ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. Just like in Genesis 1, from formlessness and void, God brings forth all creation through proclaiming the word, let there be, and there was. So now, God continues that act of creation, that act of redemption, that indeed the understanding here we see through Jesus and through the cross is that God creates redemptively and God redeems creatively. Those two are very closely associated. You know, you can't put creation in one corner and redemption over here and say, never the twain shall meet. They are, if you will, the same action and activity of God. Creating, redeeming God is who our God is, seen in Jesus. And we see again how that is working in the community. And that community that now proclaims God's reign and rule is also engaged in that creation, saying that same creative, redeeming word so that the birds can nest. and we who are the shrubs, so that the world still has a sense of love and care for the neighbor, for the least, for the hungry, for the naked, and on we can go. And so that proclaiming of the good news is participating in God's creative, redeeming action. Right? Into the hating world, the loveless world, the lawless world, the community of faith proclaims this good news. So that's why we've got some good news there in verse 14. And I just wanted to bring that in as well. Anyone want to say anything more about that? Comments? Yes, please.
I'm wondering then, are you saying that saving faith is always created out of nothing? That it is basically the theology of the cross, that in the story that we heard yesterday about the weeping woman in the hospital, where she kind of finally came to the point of emptiness, that it was the moment when faith was born out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these kind of come together at this point then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, again, if we want to think about this from the way Luther would put that, it's his explanation to the third article in the Small Catechism. I believe that I cannot, by my own reason or strength, believe. Right? So, if you will, the only thing is I believe I can't believe. So, where would faith come from? God creates it, works it in me, in us. And that's what's being, I think, pointed out in this passage as well. And of course, that faith is always active, right? Faith active in love. And so that's the dynamics of it as well. Okay, to move on then. And yesterday the little question was, name a threshing device, a type of suffering, a means of transformation, and a future expectation. And as we all know now, that word is tribulation. And tribulation, talk about that as a threshing device. Tribulum, like I said, if our stone fireplace, this would be like a threshing floor, and you would put the heads of wheat on that, or barley, or whatever, and then there would be this stone, a round stone with a hole through the center. You could put a wood shaft through and have an ox or donkey or something pull it, and as this roller rolls over the floor, it threshes out the wheat. Right? So that's the way the heads of wheat, which everything is there, that's the way in which you will get the grain. Right? And so that in that sense, right, this is a way of harvesting. It goes with the notion of harvest, and it's a harvesting metaphor. And so often, as you know, talk about end of the world or whatever has that kind of harvesting metaphor. There's the harvest, and you might be able to think again of parables that talk about that notion of harvest. And of course, Pentecost in and of itself is a harvesting metaphor. Our time of Pentecost is coming at the time of the Jewish festival of booths, of harvest. That's what Pentecost is. So that indeed, those of us as we now in our church year live in the time of Pentecost, we are living in the time of harvest. And so again, as we divide up the church year on a liturgical calendar, it's interesting to think that half the year is devoted to harvesting. which is a lot of time to spend harvesting, as farmers would know. So we have this sense of harvesting and, right, tribulation. The tribulum is a very important mechanism in that notion of harvest. And so you can say, well, boy, tribulation doesn't seem to be good news right offhand. But when you think about that as this is a way of harvesting, that this is what happens in order for fruitful grain to be brought forth, then we start thinking about it a little differently. And that's what Matthew is getting us to think about now in this latter half of chapter 24. And so there, as we start with that, verse 15, we get to that first phrase there. I'll read from the NRSV. So when you see the desolating sacrilege standing in the holy place, as was spoken of by the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Okay, so first of all, as we read those first two words, so when, you have to read them in ways that emphasize both of those words distinctly to see something else. So if you begin that passage, so when you see the desolate, that means then that everything we've talked about in terms of verses 1 through 14 is going to be connected with what happens in verses 15 and following. So that so is a connective. And so in that sense, to say what we're doing here in verses 15 and following is going to develop and help us understand what happened in those first 14 verses. So that's the one connective. The other way to read that you have to read this is, so when you see the desolating sack. So okay, now we've got the when question, which takes us back to one of the questions the disciples asked. When, in verse 3. And the answer to the when question is, when you see the desolating sacrilege standing in the holy place. And so now we have to get all the historians going here, because the question is, well, when was the desolating sacrilege standing in the holy place? We've got a reference to Daniel, right? What's there from the prophet Daniel? And I'll give you a few short references there. We can look at Daniel chapter 11, verse 31. And we can look at chapter 12, verse 11. And we can look at chapter 9, verse 27. So if some of you would look at one, some at the other, and when somebody gets there, right now, would someone simply read Daniel 11:31?
His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation.
Okay, they'll set up this abomination. Okay, chapter 12, verse 11 of Daniel. Anyone again?
And from the time that the continual burnt offering is taken away, and the abomination that makes desolate is set up, there shall be 1,290 days.
Okay. So, and chapter 9, verse 27.
He shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week, and for half of the week he shall make sacrifice and offering cease, and in their place shall be an abomination that desolates until the decreed end is poured out upon the desolator.
Okay. Now, if you read this carefully, Daniel doesn't help us much. The reason for set up the abomination of desolation. It's going to be an object, like something is going to be set there. The last one we read talked about the desolator, the abominable desolator. It's like a person. And so now everybody goes through thinking, ooh, is it an object? Is it a person? What are we talking about here? Okay, right? The incident that Daniel is probably referring to is the incident that happens in 168 before the Common Era, where Antiochus Epiphanes sets up an altar to himself in the temple in Jerusalem, right? The altar of burnt offering, is, as it said there, is taken out, and an altar to himself is set up. So it seems that Matthew is picking up on that imagery and looking at that. What are candidates for that? There are three kind of major candidates for what Matthew might be talking about here. Some say it might go back as far as to Caligula's attempt to put his statue in the temple in the year 40. Others say, and this is the most prevalent interpretation, that this is talking about the fall of Jerusalem and the looting and burning of the temple in the year 70. And others say that it might be a more general understanding, and what it's talking about is the situation that Christians face as we come to the close of the first century, where every year as you go to pay your taxes, you are also to offer your pinch of incense on the altar to Caesar to declare that Caesar is Lord, to declare your loyalty and fealty to Caesar and the empire, and that by offering that pinch of incense, that too would be an abomination. And so those are some of the instances there that are happening. And so as we read this, so when you see this desolating sacrilege, now knowing it could be an object, it could be a person, it could be these three historical events, right? When you see that, it then says, in that most interesting little parenthetical remark, let the reader understand. Okay, readers, what do you understand?
Nothing.
Nothing. What are we to understand? Just stumped, huh?
It's
be prepared.
That picture that you drew of putting something else in front of God.
Okay. It's back to if you weren't there. Right? As we were talking about already in verse 1, that sense of having Christ as the focus for all of that. What is our horizon? What do we see back here? Well, again, we were saying there was the notion of the temple, but then also how does one act and understand when the temple or whatever it is in which we place our hope and think that there is the presence of God when that comes crashing down. But now what, if we work with that, now what does the abomination of desolation tell us about that? What is the reader to understand? This is kind of a hard one. Well, what I think what we're getting here is Matthew's sense Matthew's way of helping us understand and interpret Scripture. He goes back and the term that he's talking about in terms of the sacrilege and everything is in Daniel. Right? But is he concerned about what really happened in Daniel? Is he interested, if you will, in what happened back then? No, not really. But what is of significance there is that what happens then has something to say for us now. I think that's what that little parenthetical remark is all about. Let the reader understand. If you can read the signs, and the signs are always in terms of, is there something then that happens now? So if there is that abomination of desolation, that desolating sacrilege, I'll just use this short form here. Now you readers who understand, what's the sacrilege now? To look at it this way, to say, we can say in Matthew, that sacrilege might be, we'll just pick the most popular interpretation, the fall of the temple. But to say, okay, that was then. You who are smart, what does that mean for now?
I kind of read it as desolating sacrilege. It sounds like, you know, you understand desolating sacrilege and that it's Jesus is the one who is thought of by others as the desolating sacrilege, the one who stands in front of the altar and trying to take the place of God. That's how I was reading it.
All right. Others? What does this passage mean for us now? Yes.
Well, I wonder if one way of reading this would be as a warning against doing that ourselves, that we should make a desolating sacrifice.
Okay, and what would that be? Develop that a little more.
Well, the literal thing that happens in each of those cases is that something replaces the proper object of worship. So whether that's a statue of Caligula or whatever it is, and you put the, so it's a kind of idolatry.
Okay.
Warning against idolatry, and you can think of any number of things that in your earlier language become the horizon or have that idolatrous function.
Well, I think of it as putting myself there instead of God outside my, you know, outside and within me, putting myself at the center of my universe.
So you yourself are the desolating sacrifice.
If I put myself there in that place.
In that place. Anyone else?
I think there's this essence of personal responsibility in the passage too. You, when you see and let the reader understand, sort of putting the responsibility on that person.
Okay, what kind of responsibility is that?
For being aware.
Okay, it's the responsibility for being aware. Any other kind of responsibility?
Making a wrong right.
Making a wrong right? What does that mean? Say a little more about what does making a wrong right mean?
Well,
realizing my awareness that when I place myself in the center, when I see, I don't know, somebody help me.
I think part of this declaration, you declare what you see to be an abomination. Mm-hmm. You said that Canada has a national religion of soccer.
So hockey.
Abomination!
Declaration of what we see sometimes is needed to be made when these things move in on us.
Okay, so there's that sense there of making a declaration, or I'll just call it simply, and there's a notion of naming, and that's, I think, part of making, or, you know, name, just saying this is wrong. Or, and I think what also goes along with this, talked about that a little bit yesterday, a sense of resistance. I think here the metaphor, especially if you use Daniel and the example of what happens in Matthew and all of those kinds of things, part of that again is an action by the community. That awareness or placing any other object or person in an idolatrous situation, even yourself at times, because you're often a self in community and whatnot, I think there are a tremendous amount, there is a tremendous amount of political notions that are here. Right? If we think about offering that pinch of incense to Caesar and you say no, right? That's politics. In the good sense, but it's one that's going to get you into trouble.
When you gave the example of Antiochus, I was looking at 16. It says that let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. I was thinking of Judah Maccabee. I mean, was that a reference to that? I mean, that's a pretty political.
That's the era in which all of that
right.
happens.
Right.
Yeah, the Maccabeans come
as a
response to that.
Right.
And that's
very that was resistance. You know, and that was a guerrilla movement, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very political.
Is that what 16 is referring to?
No, probably here the fleeing to the mountains is the sense about the destruction of the temple and it's when Jerusalem is besieged. The Christian community in Jerusalem goes out into Pella, P-E-L-L-A, the wilderness there.
Yeah, but that's when Antiochus, I mean, when he came in and destroyed the temple, they did the same thing. It was in Judea. They went into the mountains.
Right. Yeah. That's right. If you're thinking about what happened in Daniel, what you're saying is correct.
But the reference here is not.
No, I think in Matthew the reference is more to.
Okay.
The siege of Jerusalem in 70. Again, there's parallels
there.
History
repeating itself in ways.
Yeah, maybe. Anything more about this political resistance stuff? About that, the way in which you address that desolating sacrilege?
I'm just having a hard time reading this individualistically at all. It looks communal to me. And so I think it's great that people get an individual kind of message out of this, but I'm not getting that. And so is it meant to be a sort of an order to a community, as a community, to do something literal? Or is it really meant as a metaphorical sort of thing for an individual?
Well, what do you mean as
well,
literal.
It looks as though whole groups of people are supposed to flee together and to act as a body.
I think there's more of that communal dimension there, yes. The fleeing may or may not be literal. Right? We can talk, if you will, nowadays about, you know, maybe Christians need to flee imperialistic notions. mean, I don't think that means that you're going to establish base camp up at Holden Lake, but you're still fleeing. That's one aspect of it, right?
As a group, in a way.
Yeah, I think here for Matthew that he's emphasizing the communal dimension of this right now. Yeah.
Is he emphasizing that there's a greater right than what you're told by its government?
Yes.
And that we have that obligation to think through it and maybe take a risk to honor it and not honor what's being told for us to do.
Yes. I mean, certainly that's going to be the case in Imperial Rome, where Rome asks you to, if you will, worship or offer your pinch of incense to Caesar, and the Christians say no. Right? I mean, the statement, Jesus is Lord, quite frankly, is a political statement. Right? Nowadays, we'd say something like, vote for Jesus. That's what it's talking about. Because that's the one who you want as your next president. Anything else you want to say about the political? See, we always get so uneasy when we go political. But you're extremely political. You know, our worship is very political. Right? Have you thought about that? Yes? No? What?
It's the language here is really. I mean, I always look for a book. It's really hard for me to see. I'm stretching to see the political take, other than the reference to Daniel, which has more political overtones. But this language is really hard for me to see that way. That's why.
I guess where I'm seeing that is down around verses 23 and following. If anyone should say, look, there's the Messiah. No, there's the Messiah. You know, go and do that. This is definitely where Jesus is. Be very suspicious. Mm-hmm. It seems to me to say, take note. I have told you. I've warned you people will do this. Don't follow where the corpse is. The vultures will gather. Mm-hmm. In other words, if someone says Jesus is definitely in favor of this, then worry.
Yes.
I've been attempting to read John Dominic Crossan's book on the Kingdom of God and Imperial Rome and the conflict between them. And that dates earlier than Matthew's, I recall, the Pauline material. So already Paul is hijacking the terms that are used for the divine Caesar and applying them to Jesus, which is very political. It's very in your face.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, remember, as we go back to this, as we talk about the coming, anybody remember, what's the Greek word for coming, the coming of Jesus?
Parousia.
Right? Which in classical Greek literally just simply meant presence. But within these times, parousia was talking about the state visit by the emperor. Because after all, that's when the emperor will grace us with his presence. Right? That's a big deal, state visit. So, I mean, what we're talking about here, again, in part of the politics, if you will, is what happens when Jesus makes his state visit. And what do we think about that when Jesus says, I am with you always? In other words, it's a state visit that hangs around all the time. Right? That's where it's there. And again, it becomes political because it's communal. And wherever there's a community, there is some sense of politics, how we live together going on. And there is also notions of power. Right? And power is not a bad word. Right? Power is that which holds us together as a community. Right? It's not force or violence. Yeah, Frank.
Is it a possible modern example of that sacrilege when very widely known and influential preachers, Christian preachers, that. For instance, the man who has become president was chosen by God, whether he was elected or just got in through the back door or a little crack. He was chosen by God, and therefore we have to listen to him no matter what.
Well, to be safe, I could say, given that I'm in Canada, how could I come? But, you know, obviously that's something to think about in terms of what happens where, I mean, you know, as a Christian, to be sure, right, a separation of church and state does not mean that our faith has absolutely nothing to do with politics or government. But there is an understanding that you don't put the two together such that, again, if you will, the government becomes, or a political party or ideology or whatever, becomes the altar which you worship. So there's, I mean, that's again a question of judgment and discernment. What's happening? What's going on there when statements like that are being made? What's going on there? We'll use a historical example, you know, in the American notion of manifest destiny. Right? I think manifest destiny is a rather idolatrous claim. And all sorts of terrible things happen because of that. Right? That's what, I mean, I think that's what's happening here. And again, let the reader understand is Matthew's way of telling us that in every time we need to look at that relationship between some object or some power that is trying to become the sacred center. And any time that is other than God, there's trouble.
Isn't that just the first commandment?
Yeah.
What else is new?
What else is new in that one? But, you know, if we could keep the first commandment, the other nine would be a piece of cake.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And in that sense, that's what it always comes back to, isn't it? Precisely that. All right, let's move on. We're going to talk about fleeing. I think here again the sense is simply the urgency that comes. The historical reference there is the notion of how the Christian community fled Jerusalem and went to Pella. Verses 17 and 18 that happened here. Right. The one on the housetop, don't go down to take what's in the house. The one in the field, don't turn back to get a coat. The reference here is to, you know, don't go down, don't search for food and clothing. In this time of tribulation, don't let your desire, even for the necessities or comforts of life, or even your valuables, finally rob you of your life. Time is of the essence. Right? Get out of this place, wherever that place might be. 19, woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing infants in those days. Again, here I think it's simply a sign of compassion, right? You know, alas for those, my compassion goes out for those the least, for those who are the most vulnerable when these things happen. And the response to that is what? Pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath. Why wouldn't you want your flight in winter? Well, winter is the rainy season, and that's when travel would be the most dangerous. So that again, hope that your flight can be as safe as possible. Pray that it's not on a Sabbath. Well, if you're a strict observer of the Sabbath, you're only allowed to walk 2,000 paces. Right? And so...
Why is Jesus invoking the law here?
It's a very good question.
I mean, other times, he does a lot of things on the Sabbath that most other Jews would do.
Yeah. The only thing that I have read and that I also think is somewhat credible is there still, it might be the possibility that Matthew's community is still a community which observes the Sabbath.
Well, another, if you take the first commandment piece, I mean, the first commandment is the first one. The Sabbath commandment is second, third?
Yeah, depending how you count. Third.
Right. So, in that respect, if the most important thing is to not get, you know, scammed by idolatry, it is, in some ways you could interpret it as saying, forget the Sabbath, you don't want to have to go over the Sabbath, but you're going to have to flee. And fleeing, you know, it's that important that you flee that you even violate the Sabbath, because this is that much more important. I mean, that would be the other.
It says pray that it's not.
Pray that it's not on Sabbath, but because, oh my gosh, you're going
to
have to flee on the Sabbath. Yeah. So it's just kind of saying, you know.
Either way, it wouldn't be good because within Judaism at that time, there are both interpretations in terms of, in times of war
right.
or something, should you fight on the Sabbath
right.
or not? And they were split. I mean, right. pragmatism says, you ought to fight on the Sabbath because, you know, the other army decides to attack on that day, and you just kind of sit there and say,
yeah, I gotta eat this.
You know, you're kind of in trouble, right? So, but anyway, why would we have this in Matthew? Pray that it's not on the Sabbath. It's scholars who look at this and work their way through it say maybe this gives us, it's one of those little clues about Matthew's community, and that Matthew might still be a Christian community which also observes the Sabbath and some of the Sabbath rules.
I wonder if looking at it a little more metaphorical, that the fleeing for modern people, for our contemporary situation, would be more of more abstract in resisting the powers that be, like in Walter Wink, resisting the evil of the day, recognizing it, calling it, naming it what it is, and understanding it, and then as a community and as individuals, it's both and. Resisting and attempting to overcome it, and that's the fleeing. I mean, you're fleeing the power and the evil of the abomination. Is that possible?
But then how would, say, pray that it's not the Sabbath fit in there? Right? I mean, I understand what you're saying in terms of fleeing, but this specific, you know, pray that you wouldn't have to flee, that you wouldn't have to... Huh?
I really liked your story about it being a Jewish community.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Okay, then. Let's move on. Verse 21. For at that time there will be great suffering. And again, that word suffering there is our word tribulation. There will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now. No, and never will be. Now that's, read that carefully again. That's kind of funny. It's like this great tribulation is the greatest there will be, but it gives the sense it's not the end or the only one. What we have here is a phrase which seems to say that, yes, this is the great tribulation, but there might be other tribulation that comes after. So that again, the sense here about a notion of ending is not ending, that here we have again, I think here, a more historical point of view that recognizes that the community of faith goes through suffering, and yes, indeed, there might be points of great suffering, like the siege of Jerusalem and all that happens, but don't think that after that there will be no more suffering. It may not be as great, it may not be as life-changing, but there still will be more suffering, more tribulation. So that again, probably to use this in a negative way, this is the kind of passage that says, don't buy that rapture stuff. Mm-hmm. Right? To say, oh, somehow you're going to get raptured out of this, and you know, somehow here you are on the threshing floor, and then all of a sudden, there you go, and here comes the wheel. And no, I'm sorry. The roller's going to roll over you. And sometimes it might roll right over you, which is the great tribulation, and sometimes it might just skim you a little bit, and we were lucky this time. Right? But the sense here, I think, of this passage, again, is always that, right, the Christian message and the Christian way is not a way of escape or denial. Its word is always, you will go through tribulation, but God goes through with you. God accompanies you, and therefore you will get through it. But you're going to go through it, and you'll get through it. There's no escape. The Christian faith is not some kind of notion of end run, or one of the metaphors I use to take it back to the understanding of baptism. Baptism is not some kind of activity where you undergo a divine lamination so that now you become waterproof and suffering proof and trial proof from everything that happens. Right? Baptism doesn't laminate you. Right? You're still going to get soaked and messy and soggy, but you will get through. That's the assurance, that's the promise, and I think that's what is being advocated here as well. Moving into verse 22 on this. And if those days had not been cut short, no one would be saved, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Again, the way this verse is arranged here, note that the first two verbs in this sentence are past tense. Now, isn't that a quirky little thing, to speak in the past tense about the future? The indication there, again, I think, is a notion of showing how, if the future can be addressed as past, right? What will happen is also what has happened. We have that sense of that, and therefore, knowing that, we can be prepared for what is coming. That again, that sense of we will go through, but we will get through the tribulation. Because after all, it is a time of harvesting. And for that harvesting comes the fruit, the profits, the goodness from all of that. Next section there, again, and it's been alluded to earlier. Right. In all of this time, if somebody says to you, look, here is the Messiah, there he is, do not believe it, for false messiahs and prophets will appear and produce great signs and omens, or again, I would translate that from my reading of Greek, signs and wonders to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. So here we are again, back to false teachers, false prophets. That's always, you know, the big problem for Matthew. If there is any problem, there's that problem of false teachers, those leading you astray. And this time, the difficulty that's there, and you know, this can become difficult too, is watch out for their zeal, their earnestness, their sincerity, because that can be deceptive. These false teachers are those who find Christ in extraordinary places and in special venues, in locations that are not easily accessible. In other words, the understanding here, and we see that, think about the understanding of the last judgment. Where do you find Christ? In the one who is hungry, in the one who needs to be clothed, in the one who is sick or imprisoned. Right? In that sense, you don't have to go to Holden Village to find Jesus. You can find that person right next to you. And that's not criticizing Holden, but that sense of, you know, there's got to be these special places, and you've got to do things in this special way, and you've got to have earnestness and sincerity and all of that. I think, again, from Matthew, something that helps us understand this. Matthew chapter 7, verses 21 to 23. If someone would read that, please. Matthew 7, 21 to 23. If anyone has it, just read it for us, please.
Not everyone who says to me, "Lord, Lord," will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, "Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and cast out demons in your name, and do many deeds of power in your name?" Then I will declare to them, "I never knew you. Go away from me, you evildoers."
Okay, and you evildoer there. Greek. You workers of lawlessness. Ooh, we know all about that, don't we?
It's good.
But what do you think of that passage? Right? Lord, Lord, and Jesus says, go away. We prophesied in your name, Jesus said.
It really is intimidating. Yeah. Because I think that so easy to kind of see the hypocrites out there. And yet I think that speaks to each of us that, you know, we can feel we're saying, "Lord, Lord," and we may be the ones that are not at home.
Well, and in here, Jesus says, "I never knew you." And there's a big difference between, you know, doing works of power and prophesying and casting a demon out and knowing your neighbor. And so when you know someone, it's not about having power or prophesying and telling them the truth. Knowing a person is different than that. It's being right, like we've been talking about, being right there with that person in their moments. And so if you don't know people that way, Jesus doesn't know you either, because you've never met him in that way.
Anyone else?
Yep. It has to seem like workers of words rather than workers of deeds. And that lawlessness, that law and lawlessness, the idea of using just words
Yeah, there's the notion of word, or we'll say it that way, just words. In terms of notions of zeal and all of that kind of stuff. But I think that one could also say, in some senses, there's certain kinds of just deeds, too, to link it back to our chapter 24, right? They're doing signs and wonders. I think even in what you write, there was some casting out of demons and stuff like that. Yes?
Jesus didn't want signs and wonders. He wanted us to do the will of the Father in heaven as we work with compassion and healing.
Okay, so that's right. There's that contrast between workers of lawlessness and to use our other understanding there, works of love.
I was kind of thinking about it, and it seems like some of these people just do things because they're supposed to, so they get into heaven, and you know what I mean? Like, you're a good person, you try to help people so that you can get into heaven, when really you don't actually. I think that we all have a plan, that God has a plan for each one of our lives, and it's not necessarily to go out and save the world or whatever for the wrong reasons, you know, and we need to follow His will for us, which, you know, would happen with good deeds and stuff, but because of Him, not because we're just trying to get to heaven.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not our plans on how to get to heaven. And I think it can cut harder. It's not even our piety. That even just to say, yeah, well, it's just me and Jesus. Right? I don't have Minnesota down very well.
Pretty good.
But, you know, oofda, that can be a problem too, can it? Right? Because, I mean, part of this here is, if you will, as Lutherans, we want to talk about justification by faith, and that's there in Matthew 2. The difficulty here is we're talking about justification by sincerity, or by zeal, or by piety. We can keep going with that, right? That's not going to work. Just because you're pious, go ahead.
Well, and the works of love and so on are not intended to be to find salvation. They're a response to the wonderful free gift of God.
Right.
Which is often mixed up by those who preach zeal.
Yeah, yeah. Let me give, if I can find my reference here, one more. Deuteronomy chapter, if I can read my writing, 13, 1 to 3. Someone would turn to that. Deuteronomy 13, 1 to 3. If someone would just simply read that.
If a prophet arises among you, or a dreamer of dreams, and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or wonder which he tells you comes to pass, and if he says, let us go after other gods, which you have not known, and let us serve them, you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or to that dreamer of dreams. For the Lord your God is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul.
Did you catch that? Again, and Matthew here as well, signs and wonders aren't good words, really. Those are all, remember, it's always Jesus' opposition who's looking for a sign and wants Jesus to do wonders. And here, within the tradition itself, right, even if you have a prophet or a seer who can do signs and wonders and they work and they come true, if they say and they proclaim something other than God, forget them. Don't be deceived by signs and wonders. Again, to look back to Matthew 28, what's the key here when Jesus says, teaching them all the things I have commanded you. That's what counts. Don't be led astray in other directions by other teachings, other claims, other understandings. It's that claim there of Jesus among us and with his word that is there for us. I want to say one more thing to jump all the way to verse 28. I know it'll be more than one more thing, but we have to do this one. Right. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. And since it's time for coffee break, it's time to talk about vultures. Right? In other words, what Jesus is saying here, if you're looking for signs, you can say, you know, if there's a carcass down there, you know how the vultures circle around. And what he's saying is that as clear as a carcass is to vultures, and how circling vultures indicate a dead carcass, so clear will the coming be. Or perhaps with regard to this notion of false prophets. Right? You will always find false prophets circling over a dying world. And so that, again, is that call to Christ himself, who is the Word, and taking our clue from that Word. We are not vultures circling over a dead and dying world, but like Christ and following his mission, we are ones giving life to the world through the word of Christ and those works of love. And that's where I'll end it. Thank you very much. It's been a very good week.